So far I've talked about methods of meditation and the obstacles to meditation, and today's talk I wanted to cover what really assists the meditation, how you can empower the meditation and the qualities to develop to give the meditation that bit more oomph. In particular, in this talk I wanted to cover what in traditional Buddhism we call the five indriyas, or the five controlling faculties, the five aspects of one's meditation which gives it direction and force, and also at the same time the four Itipadas, the four literally the roads to power, the roads to success. So these are the qualities which once you can identify within yourself as being present or being very strong or very weak, then you can understand just how to give the meditation more focus, more direction, more power. These are teachings of the Buddha, which the Buddha gave especially for those people meditating, especially for those people wanting to train their mind, realize some of these states and develop wisdom. The five controlling faculties, the five indriyas, and the word indriya means like controller or lord, or things which literally like guide something else. The five controlling faculties in brief are sada or confidence, faith, virya or energy, sati, mindfulness, samadhi or sustained attention, and panya, wisdom. And the four Itipadas, which fit in quite neatly into the five indriyas, the four Itipadas are the will sustained on a particular goal, the energy which is also sustained towards that goal, the mind applied to that goal, and investigation applied to achieving that goal. Four Itipadas. Now, to get into them in detail, the first one, the faith, confidence, is such an important aspect of achieving anything in meditation. And that faith and confidence has to come in two parts. I've already mentioned this in another talk, that you have to have like confidence in your own abilities to achieve these things. You have to know it's possible. And this is almost like a mission I've been on the last few years, is just to talk about things like jhanas and to tell people they are possible. Because certainly when I was a young monk, we never used to really talk about these things very openly. And, you know, we just said, oh, make your mind very peaceful, make your mind as calm as you possibly can, without sort of coming out and mentioning even a word, jhana, and without really explaining them in depth. However, that the result of that, of not really talking about them and explaining them in depth, is that people got the idea that these things weren't possible these days, and no one talks about them, no one can do them. And that sort of comment or that sort of question just really gives me a lot of concern if someone comes along and says they're not possible these days, or it's only special people, either you're born with jhanas or you ain't, and that's just the end of it. Because that really cuts at that first spiritual controlling faculty, the faculty of confidence. It gives rise like doubt in people's minds. That, you know, maybe everyone else in this group can do it, but not me. Maybe when they sort of gave out the jhana gene in the DNA molecule, that perhaps you didn't have it. That actually comes because when I was having my breakfast this morning, that I was just reading the soybean carton, and it said no genetically modified soybeans in this product. And wouldn't it be really wonderful to be able to find, if it was true, that gene inside of you which blocked meditation, and so you can sort of modify your genes and then you have no trouble meditating afterwards. Maybe you've still got some relics of the Buddha. Maybe you can sort of get some relics of the Buddha in that, decode his DNA, and then you can sort of modify your own to be the same. However, it does not work that way. You've got enough good genes inside of you. You've got everything it takes in order to become fully enlightened, so certainly to get jhanas. So that bit of confidence there is so necessary to give people. So they say, well, instead of worrying and doubting, can I do this, can I not do this, I'm going to do it. It's just a matter of when. And whenever you are meditating, be careful of that obstacle to that first controlling faculty, which is like self-doubt or belief that I can't do this. And it does not matter how long you've been meditating, how many years you've been a monk. It doesn't matter, because anyone who knows about these stages knows that you can be just that close to good meditation and think you're miles away. You can be right in the vicinity and go right past the door there, and it's just only just one step inside deep meditation. You just don't realize how close you are. And so the teachers will come along and say, you know, you don't realize how close you are, and you think, no way. So I can't even sort of get to the first stage, let alone second, third and fourth stage, let alone jhanas. I'm miles away. It doesn't work that way. It's as if you go backwards and forwards, parallel to the path which just goes over into those jhana states. And this is why it happens. And this happens so often, that a person is meditating for years and don't seem to be getting anywhere. And then they come and talk with the teacher or talk with me and say, don't know what I did, but something happened and I got into a jhana and just can't get it back again. They just fluke it. Or they do something right. They realize, at least from that experience, that they are actually quite close. And they don't know exactly how they just crossed over, but it was just something very easy to do at the time. They can't quite remember how they did it. And it's the same with even the enlightenment experiences. Sometimes you can be very close. You've heard all these teachings, especially the monks. I mean, the monks have not just heard them, they've memorized them, they can chant them, they can quote where they are in the suttas. You know, what verse, what chapter, what page sometimes. It is so close. And all you need is just one little trigger, just almost like a hair trigger, and then just cascades into sort of enlightenment experience. It's like all the snow is on the mountain there. You've got all of the learning, all of the knowledge, all of the teachings, and all you need is just some little sound to start the avalanche of Dhamma arising in your mind, leading to full nirvana. So you're not that far away. You're human beings. You've been born in a realm where the Dhamma is still being taught and still being practiced. You're in a realm where there's still arahats alive in this world who are teaching. So when you know this, it gives you the confidence that all the ingredients are there. You just need that magic little hair trigger, a bit of yeast, just to make it all happen. And very often you can see that if you're reading suttas, reading especially those teachings which give like the life stories of practitioners. And it's a very good read to get hold of a copy of the Theragata or Therigata. These are like the verses of the elders, the verses of the senior monks and nuns in the time of the Buddha. And just to see what they went through. And to see that they actually were no different than you. That they too had the same defilements, the same problems, the same sore knees, the same difficulties. I remember reading one of the Theragatas about a monk, and it says, I've been a monk for 40-50 years, and every time I go on alms run, I never get what I like. And I thought, yeah, spot on. I can relate to that. With exactly the same feelings and thoughts in an Indian monk 25 centuries ago, sort of a Western monk in this age. And you see that beautiful I forget what her name was now, that nun who've been practicing for years in a meditation, not just a 9-day retreat every year or every couple of months, but was practicing diligently day after day, I think for 7 or 8 years, I think. And then she didn't get anywhere in her meditation, not a moment's peace. Her mind was all over the place, couldn't stop thinking, couldn't sit still. But after 7 years, she'd had enough. You know this story before, I've told it many times. She just had it. But she couldn't disrobe. She didn't want to go back to that. So she just went off into the forest with a rope. And she tied one end of the rope to a tree and the other one round her neck. And she was just about to jump off. And that's how desperate she became. And I think some of you can appreciate what she was feeling as well. Sometimes it's like that, isn't it, in the meditation? That's why we don't have any loose string around a meditation retreat. Anyhow, what happened was amazing, that just as she was about to jump off, then her mind was released. Amazing that she could be so close but think she was so hopeless. And these other nuns in that book there, years and years meditating, getting nowhere, and just this lady Patachara comes along, this bhikkhuni, great teacher, just teaches in a slightly different way, or gives like confidence and faith, says it can be done. She telling the other nuns, I'm an arahat, if I can do it, surely you can. But what happened to me with losing my husband, my kids and my parents all on the same day? And she inspired that confidence that it can be done. And it's amazing, the confidence it can be done is perhaps 90% of the ingredients to make it happen. Even when I was a school teacher, I was only a school teacher for a year, deliberately, just for the experiment, just to find out. There's one of the kids I found out the year before had come bottom of the class in mathematics, and I decided just to give him a bit of extra attention. I couldn't give that sort of attention to every kid in the class and every sort of class I was teaching, but I gave that one kid special attention just to see what would happen. You know, if you really gave a child encouragement, extra care, extra tuition, you know, just at the end of the class, no more than that, and blow me down if he didn't come top the next year. It was only sort of a low grade in the high school, and that really had an effect on me, because that really showed me just like how encouragement can turn a kid who was supposed to be stupid into a kid who was smart. And I kept on asking myself for years afterwards, was that child smart or was it stupid? Or was it just it believed it was dull, or it believed it was stupid? It bought in to that sort of label. It believed I can't meditate. It believed I can't become enlightened. It believed other people can but not me. And you can see the power of that lack of faith, or the power of faith. Some of the great teachers are the teachers who teach exactly the same as everyone else, but inspire like faith. The ones who can convince people it can be done. It's like the great coaches and sports teams. They're not the ones who've got all of the great tricks on how to win the match, or how to move the ball around. They're the great coaches who can convince the team they are going to win. They can beat the other side. They will beat the other side. And if you have that sort of charisma to be able to convince someone, then you're a great coach. You're a great teacher. You can get people to do things which they don't believe they could achieve themselves. This is why the controlling faculty of faith is so strong, are so important in getting a person to be successful in meditation. It is why that sometimes if you stay in sort of in a traditional Asian country, especially like countries like Thailand or Burma, not so much in Sri Lanka, but in countries where people have got so much faith in the Sangha, in the monks, And that if a monk says something can be done, they just believe in it, just automatically, without any question, without any doubts. And you get some of these monks in Thailand do these amazing things. There was this one monk some time ago, he would get just people from all over the place, just villagers and people from Bangkok and people who never meditated before, sitting down, and you get them into a deep meditation and take them on journeys through the hell realms and through the heavenly realms. And these people actually experience these things. And it's amazing, incredible that such a thing could happen. Or was it incredible? The reason was these people had 100% faith that this monk could do this, and this monk could lead them to these stages. And these stages actually occurred. So their confidence is just so important in your own abilities. And quite frankly, I've read just about all through the suttas, and the other monks here can confirm this. I never actually saw once where the Buddha said that a particular monk or a particular lay person had something so wrong with them, so missing in them, that they couldn't attain to these stages. The only people, he said, were barred from the enlightenment experiences were those people I mentioned it the other day, who had either shed the blood of the Buddha, who had caused a schism, killed their mum or their father or an arahat. If you haven't done that, then you're okay. You've got everything it takes to become enlightened. And I think that's only in that particular life. If it's previous lives, you're still free to become enlightened in this life. It's only like a hindrance in the life when you actually perform that act. So, what it means is that the Buddha was saying that everyone has that opportunity, everyone has a chance. You can do it. So instead of hindering yourself with, maybe I can't do this, it's just a question of when. Also, the faith, as I'm moving into this, goes into the Buddha's teachings, into the method. You're confident that if you follow the method, then eventually the results will come. And so you just give yourself up to the method. You apply yourself to the method. You give yourself up to the process. And you realize it's just a matter of time. Very often that people don't achieve as much as they could in meditation because they don't have really confidence in the teachings which either the teacher or the Buddha is giving. So that sounds okay, but it's different than the case like of an Asian who's like a very close disciple who would actually do exactly what you say. There's one story, I forget where it was from, one of these commentaries, of this monk who's a very great meditator, very wise, but liked to live by himself, nice and peaceful. And so this one young monk came and said, can I have you as my teacher? I want to learn meditation. I want to get some enlightenment experiences. And the teacher said, I don't take any disciples. He said, please, I want to be your disciple. He said, no way, go off. I want to be your disciple, please teach me. He said, look, disciples never do what they're told. That's why I don't like disciples. They just cause you a lot of problems and trouble. You tell them something, can they find a better way themselves? And so they never do what they're told. He said, look, I promise I'll do what I'm told. And so the teacher gave him a test. If you do what I say, then I'll take you on as my disciple. He said, I'll do anything. And he said, okay, start walking in that direction and don't stop. So the disciple did that. And he walked and walked, and he came to a lake, and his teacher's instruction was to carry on walking, don't stop. And so he walked right into the lake. And so it was up to his knees, up to his tummy, up to his shoulders, up to his nose. And only then his teacher said, okay, you can stop now, you can come back. You're the sort of disciple who I can use. Because, you know, you're willing to follow the instructions, even though it's going to cause your death. And that's the sort of confidence that sort of person did have in his teacher. Of course, the confidence has a danger. Because if you get a sort of a wonky teacher, then you're going to get in big troubles for putting full faith in the teachings. But the Buddha was never a wonky teacher. The Buddha is someone you can have full confidence in and full trust in. So if the Buddha taught meditation in a particular way, then it's well worth following that instruction to the letter, to the eye, to the dots of the I's. Follow it completely. And then you find that particular method works just so well and so powerfully. Because it's the case that a lot of times you check a person's meditation, and the reason why it's not working is because they're not following the instructions. And that's why I try and make a lot of time just repeating the instructions over and over and over again. So at least you know what the instructions are. Whether you follow them or not is up to you. So this is actually the confidence and the faith, both in your ability to do this and in your in the teachings' ability to produce the results, and obviously the confidence in the results, confidence in the fact that there is such a thing as jhana and it is blissful, there are enlightenment experiences and they're attainable, accessible, and also that they're worthwhile. It's again the job of a teacher to be like an advertising executive, to put a sales pitch over. The enlightenment is really wonderful, it's really great, and it's available in the shops for a special offer this weekend. It can be done, so people actually aspire towards it. And once you have like confidence in the goal, then you can develop this first of the iddhipadas, which is the aspiration to achieve that goal. The aspiration follows on from the faith, the confidence that it can be achieved and I can achieve it and this is the way. And these four iddhipadas, the ways to success, again are so important. This first iddhipada is Chanda Samadhi. It's the samadhi, the sustained willpower. So you say, this is what I'm going to achieve. I don't care how long it takes. I'm going to go for it. People fail because they give up. Not because they're unable to achieve, because they don't last the distance. And in this iddhipada, going ahead of myself slightly, in this iddhipada, the sustained attention on the goal, it's interesting that this makes it very clear, this particular teaching, which is a fundamental teaching of Buddhism, that there are goals in meditation. There are things to aim for, there are things to achieve. And it's good to set goals for yourself in meditation. Sometimes if you don't set any goals for yourself, whatever happens is fine. There's a certain amount of happiness and peace in that. But also you don't get anywhere. If you set yourself a goal, if you aspire towards something, there's suffering in that. But you'll eventually achieve that goal. This is the suffering of the journey. And unfortunately, we do have to go on that journey. We do have to try and attain something. We can't just wait for it to happen. We have to be proactive in this meditation, in this path towards enlightenment. Because without a goal, we're just like an arrow without any aim. We can just go anywhere. We just wander backwards and forwards in our life, in our existence, and we find after many years we're exactly where we were so many years ago. There's been no real change, no real wisdom, no real development of the Eightfold Path. So the Buddha actually told his monks to set a goal, but when you're setting a goal, it has to be a reasonable goal, one which you can achieve. Not sort of the goal to be a Buddha or to have all these psychic powers just like the Buddha had, or even better than the Buddha, Make it a reasonable goal, which is something which is in your power to achieve. And when you set those goals, just like I was mentioning with early on in this meditation, set the goal and let the mind do the work. Don't keep interfering in the mind achieving its goal. Don't keep interrupting the work towards the goal. You give clear instructions to the mind, this is what I want you to do, then let the mind do it. The problem with the goal, the difficulties, is the frustration which comes because you set a goal and you haven't achieved it yet. And that's when Westerners especially have a lot of frustration, basically from impatience, basically because it's challenging their particular agenda, their particular schedule. I haven't got all this time to become enlightened. I want to be enlightened this weekend, because, or this week anyway, because I've got things to do later on. So you set an agenda for yourself, and sometimes this process doesn't fit into your agenda. It has its own agenda. And so often, if you set an agenda, set a time scale for yourself, or you're someone who has impatience, only then frustration comes. It's why that one of those most moving stories, which again most of you have heard, first meditation teacher I ever had, was very wise, and I really respect and thank him a lot. He told the story when he was a young boy in Bangkok. His father gave him some seeds to plant in the garden, first seeds he'd ever planted. He put them in the ground, watered them every day. After 3 days, he'd completely lost his patience because he couldn't see anything happening. Fortunately, his father came along and explained to him that seeds are growing under the ground. You can't see them yet, but I guarantee they're growing. And his confidence and faith was restored. And sure enough, 2 days later or so, he saw the first sprouts above the ground. And he was so excited, he'd watered these flowers morning and evening. And after 3 or 4 more days, they were only a couple of inches high. He lost his patience completely, and his father wasn't around to stop him. He decided to stretch those flowers to make them grow quicker, and he killed each one of them. But he said he learned a great lesson about meditation, about flowers, about life. You cannot stretch the nature, which is really the frustration, isn't it? You can't stand nature take so long. Stretch it, and that's the problem with goals. Frustration which comes up, and you just spoil everything just when the flower is beginning to grow. So the first idipada is setting yourself a reasonable goal and sustaining that goal. So this is what I want to achieve. I don't care how long it takes, this is what I'm going to do. And that's it. I'm not going to give up halfway. I'm not going to get frustrated. I'm going to give this all the time it takes. Whether it's 9 days, whether it's 9 years, whether it's 9 lifetimes or 99 lifetimes. This is a worthwhile goal. This is what I'm going to do. That is a power. That is a guarantee for success. Eventually, you have to achieve. With that commitment to the goal, sustained commitment to the goal, then nothing can stand in your path. Not for long anyway. In this meditation, I teach in stages because it gives small goals for you to aim for as you go along. Sustained attention in the present moment. That's my goal. In this meditation, and I'm going to achieve that goal. I don't care how long it takes. You have to achieve that goal. Sustained attention in the present moment, if you keep at it. If you have the faith, the confidence it can be achieved. If you have the confidence it's worth achieving, if you have the confidence that you can achieve it, then you can sustain your attention on it. And it happens. Have the confidence that I'll have a sustained goal that I'm going to be silent for a change. It can happen. Doesn't matter how much I've tried and how much I've failed. Confidence, it can happen. Ajahn Brahm says so, the other monks say so, the Buddha says so. It can happen, it will happen, then it does happen. Giving it time. This awareness of the breath, complete awareness of the breath, the samadhi nimittas, jhanas themselves, believe it or not, is possible. And I want you to believe it, because otherwise it won't be possible for you. Give it confidence, sustain your attention on it, keep on going, and it's only a matter of time before it happens. That's why sustaining the goal is just so important. If you give up, if some doubt comes into your mind and says, well, maybe not me, maybe you've got to just be a monk to get jhanas, maybe you've got to be a special monk to get jhanas, maybe you had to be born in the Brahma realm in your last life, and just people like me who just probably came straight up from the animal realm, or even worse, no way that I can attain these things, or whatever whatever else you think about yourself. That's a lack of self-worth again is what stops the confidence arising. So that is the first of the spiritual powers, and also the first of the Iddhipadas. You'll notice that once you get the first Iddhipada of like a goal to work for, then you can start to arouse energy. It's very difficult to arouse energy when you've got no sort of goal or purpose or aim in this next hour. And if you don't really know what you're doing or why you're doing it for, what's the purpose, you might as well just go to bed. You just might just go and wander around in a circle. But if you have a clear goal and a very precise goal and confidence you can achieve it, it's amazing how much energy you can get up. So often that if someone comes along to me and says, you know, these jhanas are impossible, then something happens inside of me and say, I'm going to show them. And when you have a goal or anything like that for any reason, you really have good meditation afterwards, because you've got something to work towards, something to prove, something to do. And it's amazing just when you have a clear goal, just how much energy and how much focus you can get. So energy is caused by having goals. If you have no goal at all, no purpose, nothing to aim for in this next meditation, you find you become dull. You've got nothing to motivate you. People who get depressed and suicidal in life are people who have lost any goals. Nothing to live for, nothing to get up in the morning for, just nothing to do. And people think that's bliss, that's happiness. Oh, great, I've got nothing to do today. Got no business to do, no goals to achieve. You end up just getting dull and stupid. So, with a goal, you can get energy. That energy is the second of the Iddhipadas, the roads to success. It's also the second of the controlling faculties. And these all come together. This is where the cause of energy comes from, setting yourself a goal and having confidence you can achieve this goal. If you've got no confidence at all, no trust, no belief that this thing is worthwhile and you can do it, again, just energy just disappears completely. You just get discouraged. When you get discouraged, you don't even want to try anymore. You've just got no energy. Everything just gets so limp and dull, and you just fade away, basically. So it's because of confidence and faith, it's because you set yourself a goal, you have fuel for energy to start burning and start getting hot. And it's amazing just how that energy can really start to build up when you have a goal. I'm going to achieve this. When you start, you haven't got much energy. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to do this, don't matter how long it takes. It's amazing how you watch that energy really start to build up, really start to get strong. Sometimes you wonder where it's coming from. How can this happen at all? Because quite often it just does not make sense. sometimes that you've been working all day, sitting meditation all night, and you should be just completely sort of wiped out, tired. But if you've got a clear goal, you have all the energy in the world. I remember once just I had a very busy day, and I saw these monks. This was when I first was a monk. I saw these monks were staying up all night to make some dye for their robes, and they'd been up for about 24 hours already, and this was the second night they were going to be up boiling down this dye. And so I said, look, you've been up already last night, now you go to bed, I'll look after the dye pot, you know, for the next 4 or 5 hours. And so I did that by myself all night, and I thought, I'll be really tired when it gets to the morning meeting tomorrow morning at 3 o'clock. But I was wide awake. I had more energy than if I'd had sleep. I remember asking Ajahn Sumedho afterwards, what's going on here? I've been up all night, and I feel more energetic, more awake than if I'd had a rest. He started to explain to me about how the mind works. To understand that if you set yourself a goal, you've got something to have energy towards. You create energy. And there's an unending source of energy in there if you just know how to create it. Set yourself a goal and build it up. And of course, once you start to have energy in the mind especially, I'm not talking about bodily energy because that is only a limited amount. I'm talking about mental energy. When you have a goal, you actually see people who have that sort of type of energy. Just they've got something to do and they just go ahead and do it. And you can see their sort of commitment to the goal. You see their one-pointedness. You see the energy which they put into their task. And sometimes you think they're tireless. There must be something special about them. They can just keep on going and going and going. Well, I feel so tired. And why is that? It's because they've got a very clear goal which they're fully committed towards. And they build energy up on that. So if your goal is like to achieve jhanas, make that a very clear goal and keep on going, and you find energy builds and builds and builds and builds. As long as you keep the confidence going, you don't get discouraged or frustrated. And you find you've got all the energy in the world. It's amazing sometimes that when you come to a meditation retreat, you might start being quite dull because you know, you're making the change from life in the world to life basically in a monastery. And you get quite dull at first. But as you keep committing yourself to the goal, I'm going to achieve this, I'm going to achieve this. Keep going. The energy starts to really start to build up. And you really start to buzz along. And you come to the end of the retreat and then you're just really sort of sharp and you've got all this internal energy coming up. Where is it coming from? Because you've had a clear goal and you've built it up, built it up, built it up, built it up on that goal. Also, the energy is fun. When you have like lots of mental energy, it's like you're awake, you're alive. The mind is not stiff, because it's the dullness which really makes the mind stiff. The energy makes it just have all its power, and it feels happy. Dullness is depression, is misery, basically. The happy mind is always an energetic mind. So energy and happiness come together. To get to the really happy states of mind, they're high energy states of mind. And it's not an energy which is coming from the body. It does not depend whether you are sick and got some illness, whether you're old and weak and about to cark it. Doesn't matter how old or how weak or how sick you are, this is mental energy. And I'm not just talking just off the top of my head, because I often told the story of when I had typhus fever in the hospital in Ubon in Thailand, and I just felt, you know, completely wiped out. Just I recall, because it was an awful experience at first, because the first time I've been in hospital in a third world country, just laying in the bed there feeling like death, you know, warred with lots of other monks. And at 6 o'clock, the male nurse at the table there sort of went out the room, and I was waiting for the replacement nurse to come. 6:15, still hadn't come. 7 o'clock, hadn't come. Until I was told there was no replacement nurse. It only worked day shift, there's no night shift nurse. you had to look after yourself or look after one another, and if something went wrong during the night, tough luck, bad karma. I want to go home. But I remember just having to go to the toilet there, no bedpans, and having to, you know, like in a ward of beds, many beds together, the beds were only maybe a foot apart, and you'd be holding on to the end of your bed and had to make a lunge for the next rail because you couldn't sort of stand on your feet. And when you got to the next bed, you had to wait there for about 10 minutes to get the energy to lunge to the next one. And this is, I'm not exaggerating, this is how you work your way along the ward to the toilets, which were the end of the ward, and make a lunge for the toilet. And once you actually got to the toilet, you sat there for about an hour, not because you'd took that long to finish your business, but to be able to get the energy to make the lunge back again. And it was really, it's like climbing Everest to go to the toilet. And that's just an example of how you felt when you had like typhus fever. You just, all your energy completely gone. You couldn't even stand on your own two feet without sort of the assistance of a bed to hang on to. And even in those states, you found out, and because I've always been like interested in experimenting and sort of pushing boundaries and seeing if things were possible, that you found even in that state you can get into the deep meditation. It's amazing, just the mental states, the meditation states have got very little to do with your physical energy. It's the mental energy which they depend upon. Your commitment, your willpower, sustained willpower, your confidence, it can be done. And give it a try. No matter how physically tired you are or worn out you are, you can always get into deep jhanas if you really want to. It's mental power. So this is the second Iddhipada of Virya, but it also has to be sustained, which is one of the difficulties with people. They can pull out a lot of energy at the beginning, and then because of frustration, because of the lack of confidence, they tend to give up. And then they sort of stop applying the energy, and then they stop achieving anything, and it all falls apart. If you sustain the energy, keeping it going, keeping it going, keeping it going, it starts to build up its own momentum. You're bright, you're alert, you're awake, and as I was saying, you're having fun. Because the high energy means you've got a lot of joy in your mind. As one of the monks used to say, in this is our monastery in Thailand, he said, life looks so wonderful after a strong cup of coffee. What he's actually talking about is true. You have a cup of coffee and you've got energy, and this life doesn't look so miserable anymore. But that's only one way of developing energy. This is the way of developing energy from inside. You know, and you can do that, and you can get lots of power inside the mind. From energy, the next of the, this is the second of the controlling faculties, the second of the roads of success. The third controlling faculty is mindfulness, which is actually uses that energy. Remember that the mindfulness is the gatekeeper. It knows what's going on, and it also knows the instructions. It remembers what to do. Because if you have lots of energy and no mindfulness, then the energy becomes so dissipated into restlessness. It is like you've had a cup of coffee and too much coffee, and you're just shaking and you can't sit still for a moment. You can't sleep, you can't do anything sort of gently or gracefully, because the mindfulness hasn't channeled that energy towards that one goal. If you have a goal, a clear goal, you have energy, then you have mindfulness, then you're on the way, you're on the bus. You've got the power from energy, you've got the direction, and the mindfulness is always going to keep you on track. It's always going to make sure the bus doesn't veer off the road. That mindfulness is so important as a controlling faculty. Because I know that in my meditations, it is when I lose my mindfulness slightly and go and do something I shouldn't really be doing, but I start to waste time. I start to lose the direction, lose the power. If I keep on a goal, set my goal, and keep the mindfulness, this is what I'm going to do, remember. And I do remember, and I keep banging on the same goal, aiming at the same direction. You eventually must get there. The mindfulness is that which keeps you on track. So if mindfulness is saying there, instruct me, tell me what to do and I'll serve you, you're not getting clear instructions. Sometimes you say I should just let things be, sometimes you say I should watch the breath, sometimes you say just I should just go and think about the dinner this lunchtime. What am I supposed to do? Please tell me. If that's your problem, then give clear instructions to your mindfulness. Very clear instructions. This is my goal, this is what you're supposed to do, do it. And it's amazing just how the mindfulness becomes sharp, how the mindfulness becomes effective, and how the mindfulness acts as the guide to achieving your goal. And it stops all the distractions and the diversions. It knows where you are on the journey and keeps you on track. That's the job of mindfulness.